Well, we do praise the Lord Jesus, don't we? Isn't he a mighty God? I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a church destroyed today. Not what you really want to hear, is it? I studied theology under a number of Jesuit lecturers. We had a kind of mixed campus. The thing I liked about the Jesuits, the ones that I encountered anyway, is their great love for teaching the subject of the scriptures. They want you to develop a whole love for the scriptures. And I thought that was wonderful. Just the way it was all so relaxed. Father John Prendeville was my early church history lecturer. He used to bring heaps and heaps of slides and things in. And people would sort of get frustrated with him because it always seemed like he was just reminiscing and having a wonderful time himself. I was amazed by the end of it how much I remembered. It was great teaching methodology. But he said this. He said, when you have completed your first year, 5 years of parish ministry and get your trip to the Holy Land. He then went on to say things to look at. Well, it's over 30 years that have passed and I still haven't got that trip to the Holy Land. So what do? I have to learn from the experience of others who have done those things. And a fellow minister speaks of the first time he took a group of Methodists to the Holy Land. They arrived at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and as they got off the tour bus, just as a matter of interest, who's been to the Holy Land, any? Oh, golly, there's a whole heap of you have been along. And so you might connect with some of this. So as they got off the tour bus, a woman in the group stood on the sidewalk, looked up at the southern wall and said in amazement, "Look at those stones." Impressive indeed. Herod was an extraordinary builder. He rebuilt the temple itself and expanded the stone platform surrounding it to the size of 24 football fields. That's quite amazing, isn't it? Seven quarters of his stones are still exposed at the Wailing Wall. A great staircase has been uncovered along the south. It's not hard to imagine, I'm told, when you're there, the pilgrims scaling the steps at Passover. There are spectacular gates and arches. The workmanship and the masonry is distinctive, smoothly cut edging with a flat boss in the center. An ashlar is a thin slab of squared stone used for facing walls. You might say it's like a veneer going up of a building. In one of the tunnels, you can see a single ashlar that is 45 foot long and weighs 570 ton. Can you imagine lifting that into place? The temple itself was gleaming white with extensive gold overlay. Stunning complex had only been finished for a couple of years when Jesus and the disciples arrived. So they would have been majorly impressed by this building. It's no wonder the disciples were awestruck and said, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large building." Now, Jesus at this time, remember last week, he was just going into the temple and stayed watching people making their offerings. And here, Jesus is leaving the temple. What was it that Jesus has got against the temple? As I said last week, he was watching people. And here, now, he's clearly not impressed. What was it Jesus saw? He saw through the facade. The temple pretended to be the house of God, the intersection of human life with God's grace, a venue for sacrificing, teaching, shaping lives and communities. But the splendor of the temple could not dispel the shadow of corruption. The failure to embody the life of God in the world. Jesus wept over the sight. And to the shock of his dazzled disciples, he threatened to dismantle those weighty, seemingly permanent stones. In fact, he was killed precisely because he threatened to undo what Herod had done. The problem is not just that the temple failed to live up to the promise. It seems to be the case that as the architecture became more splendid, the possibility of genuine worship and the fulfillment of the mission of God's people dwindled. You can see it today across the great churches of England and Europe. Just take a bit of time if you're ever across, when some of you have travelled, and I'm sure you've seen it. You go in and you'll see lots of groups of people go through to admire the great structure, the skilled craft work on, I don't know, I stopped to look at the entranceway. Just amazing sculpting and everything there. Great skill, great craft, great artwork, majestic in its splendor. But the majority of people are going to look at the artwork and the splendor of the building, and they have no concept of the God that it was created and built for, that is meant to honor God, not the artist. The artist probably couldn't give two hoots about recognition. They did it for the glory of God. And it's getting missed. In the Middle Ages, St. Dominic made a pilgrimage to Rome. Pope Innocent III took him on a personal tour of the gilded, opulent Lateran Basilica of St. John. Alluding to the reply of Peter and John to the lame man in Acts, the Pope boasted, "No longer need we say, silver and gold I have none." But the humble Dominic answered, "Yes, and at the same church can no longer say, rise up and walk." Church stuff. Buildings, programs, care and feeding of the institution. These are merely means to an end. The building of assets and facilities and their maintenance is a prickly, dangerous business. It is for this. A prickly and dangerous business, because the attention to all of the plant can consume our attention and we miss the whole point. Frederick Boucher, a Presbyterian, back in the early 20th century. And he said, I think he was right when he said, maybe the best thing that could happen to the church would be for some great tidal wave of history to wash it all away. The church buildings tumbling, the church money all lost, the church bulletins blowing through the air like dead leaves, the differences between preachers and congregations all lost too. Then all we would have left would be each other and Christ, which was all there was in the first place. In a sense, Jesus' dire prediction was off the mark. Hundreds of the stones are still there, 2 millennia later, still piled up on top of one another. But he was speaking metaphorically about his death, about a truer way of connecting with God. Jesus rendered his life, surrendered his life, just outside those impregnable walls. His wounded hands and his side became our windows into the heart of God. Temples and all future structures, including our modern church facilities, were rendered obsolete. I guess Jesus knew that you don't have to physically destroy a building in order to pull it down. The temple, the church, the parish can be pulled down simply by making it irrelevant. When can we, well, we can come regularly. We can have our favorite pew. We can take our place on the rosters. We can contribute generously. We can support the barbecues, the seminars, the gingerbread house making, the carol singing, and know them all off by heart. We can show great love for one another. But if we do not have absolutely foremost in all things our love for the Lord, then the purpose is destroyed and the building, though it stands, is pulled down. On the other hand, each time we serve, each time we attend, each time we support, each time we give, out of our love for the Lord and for one another, we honor the owner of those nail-pierced hands and validate the building and the facilities. Now that's where I planned to end this sermon, but I thought someone's going to say, what about all that comes next in what we heard this morning? So I've just put a little piece in to hopefully help you put a context to it. Jesus said, be wary. Why did Jesus answer the disciples in that apocalyptic language? Why? Good question. I'm glad you thought that. Why did Mark include it in the gospel even? When he's writing to Italians. Why did he put it in there? The language is clearly apocalyptic. This kind of literature was well known in the first century, especially to the Jews. Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament are examples of entire books that are apocalyptic in nature. These books, as well as some of the non-canonical apocalypses, are full of fantastic imagery and highly symbolic. William Barclay also comments and connects it with the Day of the Lord. The Day of the Lord. Amos 5:16 through to 20, Isaiah 13:6 to 16, Joel chapters 2 and 3. And it's harking back to a time when the Jews knew no freedom. It was only natural that their hopes and dreams of the day of the Lord would become more vivid. This apocalyptic literature unveiling dreams and visions of what the day of the Lord would look like. Barclay says they were attempts to paint the unpaintable, to speak the unspeakable. They were poetry, not prose. They were visions, not science. They were dreams, not history. They were never intended to be taken as maps of the future and timetables of events to come. And if I try to kind of just explain that and say, just trying to remember the guy who said it, but basically he said, he used this illustration, he said, Stephen Hawking said this. He said, imagine a billiard table in an atmosphere-controlled environment. All the balls are set out on the table. You know the dynamic weight of each ball. And you shoot the cue, knowing the precise angle of striking and precise amount of force that you put into it to hit that ball. It will travel a precise direction, imparting a precise amount of energy into the ball it connects with, and it will travel a precise distance, whether it comes off the sides, the buffers, or wherever it lands, can be determined by the angle and the force. He said, we could work all those things out, but you would need a computer bigger than the Earth to do it, and it's way beyond our capacity. One, and this is what he said, would need to be God to work it out. So if God is so big that we cannot conceivably hold who God is in our minds, how can we know his plans? How can we know? We get glimpses. God reveals glimpses of things. They're not a roadmap to the total future. They're just telling us about things to come. And it makes very clear that the main purpose of Jesus' response is not to satisfy curiosity about the future, but to give practical, ethical teaching. Jesus combines end times with encouragement, and particularly emphasis, encouragement. He's preparing his disciples, and beyond them, the church, us, to live and to witness in a hostile world. How do we live and witness in a hostile world? Because I don't know about you, but I can get worn down. I can get worn down, and I need encouragement sometimes. And that's why we need one another who've got a clear belief. We know that we're not here for the relationships. We're here for the Lord, and the relationships grow from that. And when we've got that right, everything starts to fall into place, doesn't it? And all the wonderful artistry and all the great things that people build are all to point to what? It just struck me, like when I went into some of the cathedrals and things, and I go in, I think, this is just awesome. You could see how people would look and say, you know, they lived in, I don't know if you've looked at some of the old houses, like the doorways are here somewhere, you know, you duck down and go in. And then you think about the people who lived in those homes going into the cathedral and thinking, wow, how awesome is this God? And then you look at today's society and you see the cathedral and you see the shopping centers. What are we worshiping? That's why we need building and places, not for worship. We need them to help us to gather for a holy God, to give Him the worship, and then to live with the benefits that flows through that love for God and gives us people who will stand with us. Even when it gets tough, they'll be with us. The Lord be with you.